Okay, this is Karen Brewster. Today is August 8th, 2019, and I'm here with Michael Gates at his home in Whitehorse, Yukon, Canada. And this is an interview for the Klondike National Historical Park Oral History Project. And we are also joined by Angela Schmidt, the film archivist at University of Alaska Fairbanks. So we're going to talk a little bit today about Yukon Gold Rush history and the Chilkoot Trail and your work as a curator for Parks Canada. So Michael, maybe you can get us started with, you know, where you're from originally, you're growing up, things like that.
Well, I grew up in Alberta, and in my later years growing up lived in rural Alberta. And I aspired to be an archaeologist one day. So I went to the University of Calgary starting in 1967 and took a degree in archaeology, worked my way through university. And my connection to the Yukon is that after I got my degree, I worked for a year so I could go back for more study. And I had a job in a brewery which paid really well and lots of overtime, and I was banking the money like crazy, but it was a pretty boring job. And
What was the job?
I worked on the production line.
Oh, okay.
So the bottles would go by, and they just come up with it. Getting off the track they came up with a new novelty bottle. It was called Heidelberg beer, and they came in barrel bottles. And of course, all their equipment could handle the routine bottles, you know, the stubbies. At that time, it was stubbies. And they had, you know, things that would come down with suction cups and pick them up and all that. Well, these things didn't fit. And so all that machinery didn't work. So they had to hire all these people to handle the bottles by hand. And it took over almost 50% of the beer market in Alberta for a while. So they were just going all out day and night to produce this new beer. So I was the beneficiary of that period of employment. But I didn't want to end up working there like some of them had done for 50 years. And a graduate student from the University of Calgary in archaeology asked me if I wanted to be his assistant. He was going to the Yukon. So I said, well, when do you want to leave? He said, tomorrow. And I said, how about the day after tomorrow? And we drove to the Yukon in a 1949 Mercury one-ton truck. And that was my introduction to the Yukon. And I quickly fell in love with it and decided that I wanted to live there. And I was in love with the history. So I wanted to be there and not far away.
And what year was that?
Well, that was 1971.
Okay.
And so I came back the next year. I had a couple of projects to work on the next year, and I was hooked. And but I finally came to, well, I met a man named Alan Innes Taylor. That's AlanInnes-Taylor. And he has a very, very much part of the history himself. He was one of the first Canadians to fly, got his pilot's license, was flew a fighter in World War I, and he joined the Mounted Police, and he did patrols all over the Yukon, and then he became a purser on the Sternwheelers, and then he got an opportunity to handle the dogs for the bird expeditions in Antarctica. And then he became during World War II, he became a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force, I think. Mm-hmm. And he was a survival expert, and he did a lot of stuff related to Northern survival, wrote a manual on the subject. So, and he had a tremendous love of the history, and he could see that it was being looted and destroyed and vandalized. And so he convinced me that something ought to be done. And so I decided that's the way I wanted to go into archaeology. Forget Mesoamerica. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, you know, look at. And it, at the time, they didn't have cultural resource management, but that's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so I eventually went to graduate school at the University of Alberta, and they didn't entertain the idea of what they used to call salvage archaeology. That was too pedestrian, and it was dirtying your hands, and it wasn't academic work. And they discouraged me from that, and I didn't see much of an opportunity at the time in archaeology in the Yukon. So I had an opportunity to go to the National Museum and get training in conservation in their conservators and training program. So I spent 3 years in Ottawa doing that, and it was the most incredible learning opportunity imaginable. They brought people in from all over the world, the tops in their field, and I just soaked it all in. So I very quickly absorbed knowledge from a wide variety of fields, and that later helped me when I became a curator in Dawson. So I worked in Ottawa for 3 years, 3 months, and 3 weeks. Got hired to work with parks, and I spent 6 months in Ottawa learning everything there was to learn about. I worked with the curators. I worked through the cataloging system. I took notes and ended up with a binder that thick, about
3 inches,
almost 3 inches thick. That contained, you know, step by step every part of the cataloging process. So when I was finished, I knew it took 2 hours and 40 minutes to catalog an artifact from start to finish. That was useful later when I started working with the collection, because, we had, it turned out roughly 250,000 artifacts. And, mm-hmm. you know, you apply that that number to that number of artifacts, and I realized that you'd have 10 people for 100 years and not catalog at all. So that shaped how I dealt with the collection. Mm-hmm. So I applied for the job as the curator of collections, and I was hired in October of 1977, and I arrived in Dawson in March of 1978 and started working on the massive collection of buildings and the very ambitious program of development that they had in place. So, and that's what I did for 23 years. Worked in Dawson on the collection there. Aside from the film discovery, which was kind of a sideline, the first year I spent just getting a grip on what the collection was, where everything was, how much material there was, and what the content composition was, and formulated basically a model for how we could store and house the collection. And my boss pondered how we would ever get support for any of this, but the next spring we had a flood, and 80% of Dawson was underwater. And they gave us a blank check. Mm-hmm. And I already had I knew what we needed, didn't have to think about it. So we got the warehouses we needed and got them upgraded and developed for storing the collection. And first year I had 10 catalogers helping me. But we were working with the flood damaged material. And that continued. That work lasted for 10 years.
Wow.
But in the process, I got my collection organized. So I felt pretty good about that. And when I started, they didn't have well-formed concept of what a curator was and why we do conservation. And I had to lock up one of the buildings where the bulk of our collection was stored, because the guys in the workshop would go down there and raid it for tools.
Oh.
And they didn't understand why that wasn't, you know, it's easier than going to the hardware store. Just go down and get the spoke shave you need.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time with them. When I left, they were all wearing hard hats, which they didn't like it when I arrived, and they all respected the collection. And but it was a gradual process that over the years they started to understand.
And so were you the first curator that Parks Canada had in Dawson?
I was the first professional museologist ever hired in the Yukon.
Okay. So what inspired them to hire somebody like you to work with the collection?
Well, they had a grand master plan for developing the site. And it involved a team of curators and a team of conservators. And they were going to develop. There was one building, it was a hotel that they were going to turn into staff housing, and a very ambitious master plan. And the year that the first spring I was there, we went through that plan and started scheduling the buildings and the order in which they'd be restored and what the curatorial involvement would be. And that went to Winnipeg, and they immediately slashed it. And so the grand plan for all the curators and all the conservators ended up with me. And I had an assistant curator who was a longtime Dawson resident, and who named John Gould, who taught me a lot. He mentored me and introduced me to mining history, and it was an invaluable opportunity. But we had two curators and no catalogers, no conservation, nothing. When John retired, I converted that position into a conservator, and so we had a conservator from early on, and the first conservator I hired went on to be the provincial conservator in British Columbia. His name was Valerie Thorpe. And the catalogers that I hired, one of them continued to work with me until I retired. Until I left Dawson, I was Paula Hazard, Hassard. And she eventually got into developing exhibits, and it was natural for the work. And when I left, they had a conservator and Paula, who was sort of the senior curator, and they had a design curator and a collections manager. And then in 2011, the Harper government decided that they weren't necessary, and they wiped out the whole program and left them without any staff to care for the collection. Great disappointment to me, because when I left, that team was working so well together, and they integrated. It wasn't like, well, I'm conservator and that's all I do. Everybody kind of worked together. When there was a project, they all knew that they were part of the project, not just that's not my job sort of thing. It was delightful to see that.
And so what types of material were in the collection? Is this all Gold Rush era, or you said mining history?
Well, there were buildings and their extant contents. There was the KTM building, which contained the material that used to be sold there. There was a lot of tinwares and other products. So there were shelves and shelves of old pots and tins and you name it. We had two dredges, and all of the equipment that survived from those dredges. Dredge number four was buried 17 feet in the muck, and from the ground surface up, there wasn't much left. But when we had to move it, we had to extract it from the ground.
Wow.
It was frozen into. And as we washed away all the silt and worked our way down, everything was there. It was like they'd walked away from it. So the top half was bare, and the bottom half was, everything was intact. We had mining equipment. We had the contents of the Dawson Daily News. We had the contents from four blacksmith shops. We had the furnishings from the commissioner's residence.
Mm-hmm.
We had Robert's service cabin.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I left, there were about 25 different exhibit modules, all the way from the commissioner's residence, of which I was the team leader for that, mm-hmm. that project. We restored the building and put in fire protection and basic services, and we restored the interior to the 1914-1915 period.
And that's a building that now the public can go in and
that's
tour
correct.
Through, as I recall.
Yeah, the
right?
Prime Minister opened it in 1996. It was a big deal. And it was a fun project to, at the end of that, my time in Dawson, because we'd solely work from the first exhibit was in the window of the KTM, and I just took some of the things out of the collection. They were a little bit rusty, so we intervened in a professional conservation manner, made them presentable for exhibit. And first exhibit was Yoho bath heater. And then we started doing other window displays. Mm-hmm. And we'd had a couple of I'm trying to think of the right word, unpalatable dealings with the curators from Ottawa. It was sort of, I'm from Ottawa and I'm here to help you, mm-hmm. instead of, I'm from Ottawa, what can we do to help? You know, it was like, but they did it from afar. So instead of using items from the collection, they'd go shopping in Burnfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. They had a massive mm-hmm. flea market there, and they'd buy oh. stuff there to furnish buildings in Dawson when we had the collection here. Yeah. And so I made it one of my tasks to start taking the collection, getting them out where people could see them. Mm-hmm. Because there was a lot of, you know, people were saying, well, why are we spending all this time and money and nobody gets to see it? Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a good answer for that one. And I agreed with them. Mm-hmm. So we started a program of display cases and window displays, mm-hmm. and, you know, opportunistically used the collection. And we had graduate students in conservation working with our conservator, and we had some graduate students in museum studies working on exhibits.
Were there any models that you were following to curate something on this scale, or were you making up a lot of this as you went along?
I made it up.
Yeah.
I got a lot of ideas, mm-hmm. and you know, when someone suggested something that made sense, I grabbed a hold of it.
Are there other examples of something scale?
Okay. Yeah. We had, let's just say, I started with a number of 100,000 artifacts. Yeah. And I figured out how many hours it would take to catalog the collection. I said, that isn't realistic. And we had one of our colleagues from Winnipeg in town, and he talked about what he called inventory control. So what we did was we'd have things like a great big wooden barrel full of horseshoe blanks. Well, in Ottawa, they would take them all and they'd catalog each and every single one of them. Mm-hmm. And what I did was I cataloged one, and the rest were put into an inventory control group referencing that catalog number, because they were all identical. Mm-hmm. So one description. And if you needed more for exhibit, then we would catalog them as required.
Okay.
And that way we could work with huge groups of items, mm-hmm. and catalog one and put the rest into an inventory control group. So that's just one example. Mm-hmm.
Or a box of nails. You don't catalog every nail.
Well, don't get me started on that. I had some long discussions with the archaeologists because they were excavating material and they wanted to keep everything. And so I got one, I'm just trying to remember who it was. I got the conservator working on that and, you know, looking at the conditions and... I said, you know, what's the prospect, you know, for preserving these? And the answer was, well, in 20 years, you expect half the collection to be nothing but rust. Mm-hmm. So I went to the archaeologist and I said, hey, you know, you can't just let it sit there, or all you'll be curating is rust. And so they launched a multi-year program, and they brought teams of material culture specialists to Dawson, and they went through all these things and they took. Prototypes or
samples
yeah. And gave them the full treatment, and the rest was retained in Dawson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if there's four styles of nails, they make sure they've got one or you know,
yeah, something
a few
like
of
that.
Each.
I mean, I left that up
right.
to them.
But so that's sort of the concept, that you get the representative differences and you keep a few of them, and then... You don't need 1,000 of the same nails, but you might need 5 of them.
I think what I did was I was able to inject reality and common sense that you can't just say, well, we're going to keep it all, because, you know, physically and practically that was not mm-hmm. possible. Mm-hmm. It was not feasible. Mm-hmm. And so they directed their attention and they took out 2,000 or 3,000 specimens from the collection.
Mm-hmm. And so similar to Skagway...
Like a type collection.
Yeah, so similar to Skagway, there was historic building restoration work going on in Dawson and there was sort of salvage archaeology below the buildings before they worked on them.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. The we also, when they were restoring buildings, we took samples of things like wallpapers mm-hmm. and you know, lighting fixtures and things like that. We had a special group. There was a special accession number that we used each year to designate extant samples that were collected. Mm-hmm. So when they worked on a building, we'd get, you know, the doorknobs and the hinges and the wallpapers and things like that, because we knew that they couldn't use those in the you know, when they restored it. But it would give us an idea of what we should be looking for you know, the modern
ones. Replicas.
Yeah. The replicas. Yeah. And then I spent a lot of time, you know, looking through period catalogs. Funny thing was, one of the places we went to back in the 80s was a little outfit called Amazon.
Oh, I think I've heard of them.
Yeah. But, yeah, there were specialty suppliers, and if you just knew where to look, you could get these things. We found a place that had carbon filament light bulbs.
Wow.
So we put those into the Palace Grand Theater mm-hmm. because we knew they didn't have the bright tungsten lights. And... you know, so wherever possible, we tried to find something that was appropriate to the period.
Mm-hmm. So that means you worked with the historic building restoration crews.
Oh, yeah. I was a pain in the ass. because, you know, I'd say, well, you can't do that. Or, you know, I'd say, you know, you really have to have the right hardware here, you know. And I'd try my best to help them find what they needed.
Because, mm-hmm. yeah, on the U.S. Park Service, they have a historic architect that helped in Skagway. But in Dawson, perhaps you didn't have that equivalent position?
Oh, we had teams. We had an architect on site for many, an engineer on site. Mm-hmm. But my first encounter, I left Ottawa on my way to Dawson to start work. And at that time, our regional headquarters was in Winnipeg. And the fellow that hired me said, well, you should stop in Winnipeg on your way through. And as it turned out, they were having a team meeting for the Red Feather Saloon, which they were going to turn into a sort of a visitor interpretive center. And so I sat in on the meetings. And at the end of the meeting, I said, well, you know, you really didn't talk about the exhibits and what you're going to do inside. And one of them said, oh, well, don't worry about that when we give them the building. And I thought, huh? You should be thinking about that while you're mm-hmm. developing the thing. Otherwise, you'll get a building, you know, that suits their purposes but isn't suitable for exhibit. Mm-hmm. And so I really, you know, I really injected myself into these projects whenever I could, because I knew we'd get a better result. The engineers saw A and B, and the straight line between them. And not many of them had the right historical background. Mm-hmm. Some did. Guys like Ken Elder, he was terrific. I wish we'd had more of him working in Dawson.
And he was an historic architect?
He was a restoration architect with mm-hmm. the Restoration Services Division in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. He did meticulous work. So I get myself involved. And when I went to graduate school later on, I went to Cooperstown. And while I was away, they started a project while I was out of town. And when I got back, there are two things I remember. One, they decided to make over the some of the interior rooms in the Palace Grand Theater, including one that we'd furnished, a typical room used by one of the ladies in the, you know, the theater troupe. And they put this red and gold flock wallpaper on the walls. And I was a little taken aback by this, and I, oh golly, wallpaper expert. I met him when I was in grad school, Dick. He was the American authority on historic wallpapers. Mm-hmm. So I sent him a sample of wallpaper, and I said, you know, is this appropriate? And he sent it back and said, oh, this is 1950s. So I made them take it out and replace it. And they didn't like that.
Yeah.
But, that was a quick fix, but it wasn't appropriate.
But they listened to you.
Yeah, grudgingly. On another occasion, the second time I went away to grad school, I spent two resident semesters in Cooperstown. The second one, they started doing the Bank of BNA, mm-hmm. British North America Bank, British North America. And the restoration architect in that had lots of information on the what the interior of the bank looked like. But he saw one in a bank in Atlin that had looked really fancy. So that's what he put in there instead. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why did you do that? When you had the evidence to tell you what was actually here, and we actually had some of the counters and things, why weren't we using that? Mm-hmm. So I realized that, and by that time I'd realized that there was one restoration architect that took Robert Service Cabin and put an entirely different roof on it, because that one looked more like a roof or a log cabin instead of, you know, the one that was there. You know, they exercise these liberties.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm saying all these things, and somebody's going to curse me for saying it, but these are the facts that shape my
right,
approach.
Right.
So I really felt it was important to strive for historical accuracy where you could. Well, while I was away in that second semester, the restoration architect started furnishing it.
The bank?
Yeah. Yeah, and these artifacts started showing up, and I was looking at them and thinking, arts and crafts style? What's this got to do with the bank? And so I contacted the head of curatorial work in Winnipeg and said, do you know what they're doing? And she wasn't aware, so she put a stop to that. And I got the head of, Susan Buggy. She was the head of historical, B-U-G-G-E-Y. She was the head of historical research in the Winnipeg office at the time. And I said, what we really need is for a historian to dig out all the information we have, A, on what the interior of the BNA bank looked like, and B, what were typical bank furnishings from the era. Mm-hmm. And they produced this lovely volume. And when we restored it, and Paula Hazard played a major role in that, we used things that were in our collection, and we worked with the counters that they put in right. there that replicated Atlin, but we used things that we learned from that historical study to inform our treatment of the building. Hmm. So that the curators in Ottawa at the time, they were kind of like touchy-feely, and sometimes they took liberties. And I remember when I was in Ottawa, I said, well, where's the blueprint or plan for furnishing? Oh, I haven't got time for that. Mm-hmm. It was all, you know. So when, for instance, when the SS Klondike was restored, curators came up, installed it, and walked away. Mm-hmm. And in the fall, I came down, and I recorded the installations, where everything was, and developed inventories of everything in each of the cabins. And so that over the years, when they had to, let's say there was a leak and they had to take things out, mm-hmm. we had a photographic record of what was in there and how they were arranged so that they could put them back. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they'd start,
yeah.
you know,
right.
there'd be what I call drift. It would drift away from the original yeah. intent.
Right.
So that was something that I implemented, was always having a plan and a listing, and, you know, sort of a philosophy, or, you know, the thinking that went into developing the exhibit.
Right.
And then once it was installed, we did a complete recording of it and an inventory, so that from then on we could, for instance, check to make sure that everything was accounted for. With the SS Klondike, for example, they had an inventory. And some years later, I thought, I went down to do the fall end of season inspection. And I thought, let's just see. We took the purser's office and we had our inventory. I said, okay, let's take the things out and check them off. And we took everything out and we had everything checked off on the list, and there was still stuff in the that had never been recorded, including one item that was a loaner.
Oh, from another institution.
Yes. And so we dealt with that.
But, a little embarrassing.
Well, you know, it's not very professional.
Yeah.
And until somebody said, let's take everything out and see what's left. You know, everything's on the checklist. It's all accounted for. So, you know, there were things that I learned over the years that informed the way we did it. So every exhibit we had, we always had an exhibit inventory. And we developed schedules for inspections and what you did. Mm-hmm. And for the exhibit cases, for example, dust is a big problem. And so we sealed the cases, enclosed them. And very simple. We put a fan, and we installed an air intake with an automobile air filter. So it would draw the air through the automobile air filter before it circulated in the exhibit. And it cut the dust problem, eliminated the dust problem. Yeah. And my boss said, well, we want to have our exhibits open in the wintertime. So I had to think about that. And I went back and I looked at the exhibits. And, well, one of the big problems in the wintertime was you get condensation on the windows, frost.
Right.
So from then on, whenever we did a window exhibit, we put vents at the front so the air that we were circulating would come out and would come up across the windows and would keep keep the windows free of frost. I mean, there's no point having the exhibit if, and it also having that air movement eliminated frost buildup on artifacts.
Oh, right.
As well, and then we. We found a manufacturer who provided a particular film you could apply to glass that would filter out ultraviolet light.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that eliminated the or reduced the problems with fading. Yeah.
Right.
We had one exhibit, an Ottawa curator came in and installed, and I said, well, aren't you concerned about light? Oh, well, there's a building across the street in the shade. And I said, have you looked at the building? Have you looked at the where it is? So I did a series of tests where I put test strips, you know,
on
inside, and we monitored. And in the course of the first season, that exhibit was, it was in Madame Trombley's, things were badly, badly bleached.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, an outdoor, it's basically like an outdoor exhibit if it's in a window.
Yeah. Huh.
With all that sunlight.
So from there on, we always had the awning over the front. We put UV film mm-hmm. in. And we worked with reproductions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so after that, we didn't have that problem. I mean, after 15 years, you're going to have to deal with some issues, but not 1 year.
Right, right.
So, you know, these are all things that seem to make sense to me. If you're going to do a professional job, you know, you have to do it.
Right. And you see, you think this doesn't relate to Klondike Park, but it does, because they've faced those same issues with their collections and their historic buildings and their exhibits.
Yeah, but I didn't go down there and say, here's what we're doing.
No,
or
no, but
like
you
that.
Guys were probably
similar issues,
parallel paths, so to speak. And so for people who don't know, how is it that Parks Canada is connected to Dawson? Is Dawson City a designated historical park?
Well, it all goes back to the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada. That's the body, and it consists of a representative from each province and territory, and a member from the National Archives and one from the National Museum. And anybody in Canada can put forward a nomination. We'd like this person or this place or this event declared nationally significant. And they review them and they decide yes or no and how they would be commemorated. And golly, I've got the minutes from the meeting. It was 1957 they came up, and then they came back a few years later and did it again. But they decided that Dawson was a complex of historical significance. And they selected a cross-section of buildings from within the community, original buildings, that they thought collectively reflected the impact of the gold rush. And in later years, I led some initiatives to develop what we called commemorative integrity statements, which identified the resources, the values of those resources, and it helped guide our decision-making regarding how we intervene.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the Historic Sites and Monuments Board that gave the direction that Parks Canada should become involved. And the first two projects there were the, they tore down the Palace Grand Theatre and rebuilt it. And they designated the SS Kino as a nationally significant. And for a few years, the Klondike Visitors Association used it for entertainment, and people actually slept in the rooms.
In the berths?
Yeah, in the little berths.
Huh.
So I'm told. And But by the time I got there, it was strictly a visitor attraction.
Mm-hmm.
So by the early 1960s, Parks Canada started acquiring properties scattered throughout Dawson. And there were about 25 of buildings of one sort or another. And the commemorative integrity statement identifies the, I think there are now 19 buildings that are designated as nationally significant. Robert Service Cabin, the Palace Grand Theatre, the KTM building, Kaylee's store, the Palace Grand Theatre, let me see, Biggs Blacksmith Shop, the Red Feather Saloon. They're scattered throughout the community.
Yeah, I'm impressed you could name them all off like that. But there's also the, we're sort of getting off topic here, but the city of Dawson has a museum as well?
Well, there's a non-profit organization, the Dawson City Museum Society. And we kind of worked with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering what that relationship was.
Well,
like.
The building that, when I first started, it looked like Parks Canada was going to help restore the building. And I was told to work closely with the Museum Society. I ended up getting married to the director, who, by the way, made some muffins.
Oh,
and
oh,
you must
this,
take
this is your wife, Kathy.
Yeah, you must take some muffins away with
okay.
you.
Okay, all right. Well, that's very kind of her. So.
So over the years, those were the and then there were another group of buildings that we acquired that supported the streetscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And an example of that might be Oak Hall, or as it was called at the time, Why Not Store, was an example, or Lowe's Mortuary was another example. These were not nationally significant, but we saved the structures and we've interpreted them to the themes that are of national significance.
Mm-hmm. And so the national significance of Dawson and the Klondike Gold Rush and the connections to Skagway and the Chilkoot Trail.
Well,
summarize that a little bit.
Well, I don't think that they had.
Is there a connection?
Well, you'll see. I remember when I was working in Whitehorse, we had two framed proclamations. I think they were dated 1998, and Bill Clinton signed one, and I think Jean Chrétien signed the other, where they both sort of proclaimed that the Chilkoot Trail was an international thing. And I know that Parks Canada has had a very close working relationship with the U.S. Park Service over the years. They have a trail center that they used to have, and
right.
I don't know where that stands now, but when I was there, you know, the Parks Canada Trail Center was just across from the train station, you know, the,
right.
Mm-hmm. where they have the theater for
right.
the U.S. Park Service. And they became a bit concerned about the, you know, the they're having problems with crowding some days on the trail, and mm-hmm. so they started this registration system to, I think they limited it to 50 people a
yep.
day.
Mm-hmm.
And that was happening in the 90s.
So that's when it became a joint international park, where they
well,
started sharing management?
They work closely together.
Yeah.
You'd have to speak to the superintendents, Clay Alderson.
I've got all that. Yeah.
I just know that they, you know, they communicated well and exchanged.
Yeah. I'm just sort of wondering, like, yeah, how Dawson fits into the story of the Gold Rush.
Well, you see, back in that period, we were also looking at having a an international thing that extended from Seattle to the Chilkoot
mm-hmm.
And Whitehorse and the Yukon River, because there's a section of the Yukon River that's a heritage river, and then into Dawson, and then the gold fields with the dredge number 4 mm-hmm. and Bear Creek. And so all of these things kind of lent themselves to a unified theme, mm-hmm. which was the Klondike mm-hmm. Gold Rush. But I think it was pretty clear that the people leading the charge on the American side weren't interested in getting into an international park. And so, for instance, when we looked at a World Heritage Site, that was one of the things we thought about, was having this thing with yeah. units from Seattle all the way to Dawson City. And that fell on difficult terrain. It wasn't fertile ground. So, and again, I wasn't involved in that.
Right.
But I know that eventually they got the Trondek Wachin involved, and they led the thing in. For a while, they're going to turn it into a First Nations theme.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, they worked out a compromise where they acknowledged the First Nation component and the mining component, and sort of melded them.
Did it become a World Heritage Site?
They're still working on it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And someone like Paula Hazard would, she was managing the project after she got the boot by the Harper government. The Trondek Wachin hired her as the manager of the mm-hmm. World Heritage Initiative.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, and I know, like, the Seattle part of the story of the Gold Rush from the American side, they do try and connect that with Skagway, but you sort of have two park regions and units, and cooperation administration can be challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if doing that from Dawson and the Parks Canada, and then here in Whitehorse, cooperating across countries and agencies, was that even possible, or the challenges of that?
I was aware of what was going on, but my focus when I was in Dawson, after we completed the commissioner's residence restoration in 96, I morphed into a cultural integrity specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I dealt with policy and developing CI statements and leading the planning for CRM considerations in different projects. And I didn't get involved in the some of these other
okay.
things.
And so when did you come to Whitehorse?
2000.
Okay. And since then, what was your position?
Well, I was the cultural integrity specialist for the field unit.
Okay.
And I worked with historical material. It was in Kluwani, on the Chilkoot Trail, and in Dawson City. So I led, when they had commemorative integrity statements needed to be developed, I did that, and I give CRM training. And I worked on some projects. I helped, you know, when teams were planning projects, there were a couple on the Chilkoot Trail where I tried to be the voice for cultural resource management to get that incorporated into the thinking and the planning. I discovered that if you wait until they're ready to start the project, it's too late to say, but you forgot about that. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to, you know, horn in as early in the process as possible to get them thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us what those, some of those projects were on the Chilkoot?
Well, the one that I had the strongest attachment to was the cemetery restoration.
The cemetery in Bennett?
Well, they have a cemetery in Bennett, they have one in Lindeman, and they also have them on the trail.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep. Yeah. And between Deep Lake and Lindeman, there are some graves. They're not on the trail. You have to go around a lake and up a rock face, and you find this spot, and it overlooks Lindeman Lake, and two infants were buried there, and an adult.
Hmm.
So I gathered all the information that I had on the, you know, from old photographs and whatnot, so I knew what would they look like, and I visited and looked at what was remaining to see if that matched with what was in the photos, and took measurements and detailed what, you know, what was there, and we tried to restore the grave enclosures as accurately as we could. In some cases, the back when Corrections was doing this in the early 60s, they took some of the grave fences and they just threw them over the hill and built these ones made out of log. So in some cases, all we did was we replicated the log enclosures.
Okay.
Burial remains like that are not treated within the cultural resource management policy. They're treated as buried human remains. And there's a different policy for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I, bearing that in mind, I still tried to reflect the historicity. There's also the Mathis grave, which overlooked the 1 mile river that connects Lindeman Lake to Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
The story was the fellow tried unsuccessfully two times to take his outfit through the rapids,
yeah.
And he lost it two times, so he went up on the hill and blew his brains out.
Yeah.
And they buried him there.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved contacting various families and interested parties. The Masons, the Masonic Order, was interested in specifically in the commemoration of Masons who were buried on the trail.
Hmm.
And one of the members here forked out the money to buy stone markers.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew them in the spring, and I had them installed.
Okay.
Hmm. Those old graves, you leave the human remains there?
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't touch those?
No.
Were any of them First Nations people?
No. No. I've seen one photograph of an indigenous grave along the trail, but I have no idea where it is now.
Mm-hmm. What other projects? I was thinking, if there was trail work being done, did they have to do CRM clearance or putting in new bridges or things like that?
Yeah, and I sort of had to deal with those, you know, as they came up. And
or building a new trail shelter or something?
Mm-hmm. Oh, golly. Now, those, I'd almost have to go back to the files to get my memory mm-hmm. on those. But I remember there was one place where there was a grave right on the trail.
Oh.
At Deep Lake.
Yeah.
And so they built this, the archaeologists confirmed that they didn't go all the way down to the body, but when they, you know, surface skimmed, they could see the mm-hmm. outline. So they they built a platform you could walk over that instead of just trample it.
Oh, right. Oh, that's why that platform's there.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's no sign or anything to indicate that there's something there. I'm sure they don't want people to know that.
Christine Hedgecock was the champion for protecting things on the trail. She knew the value of the things and she knew where they were. And one of the things they did, they picked various features and they were monitoring them from year to year to see what kind of mm-hmm. human impact and natural changes might be taking place. Mm-hmm. And I remember at Bennett, people were wandering all over the place, trampling on things. And Christine, she got involved and they put railings in certain places and they took spruce needles and sprinkled them over the path so you couldn't see. Because as soon as you see that there's a treadway there, everybody walks on it.
Right.
So they covered those up and they took mm-hmm. branches from trees and they covered mm-hmm. trails so that people wouldn't see them. And mm-hmm. it was just a very subtle way of directing, keeping people on certain mm-hmm. paths. There were things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I know from personal experience, it's difficult to monitor the hikers' activities. And I know that hikers are taking things off the trail.
Still?
Oh, well,
I mean, certainly.
Let's say this. I saw it in 1973 mm-hmm. when I worked on I did the archaeological survey before the Skagway Road went in. And that involved being at the summit of the White Pass. And I remember being in the, we took the train back from the summit and we stopped at Bennett for the big meal. Boy, were we hungry. And there were a couple of fellows there and they were showing us the moonshine jug they looted. And some people had, they'd select what they wanted and then they go smash everything else thinking, well, that makes my piece more valuable.
Wow.
And I heard stories about that, but I also saw people doing that. And then when I was working for parks and I was going into, at various times I would go to Lindeman or to the summit or to Bennett. And one time I remember hiking in via Bear Loon Lake and I met some hikers on the way and they had things dangling from their backpacks.
Wow.
So, and they didn't see any, how could that hurt? I thought, well, it's 50 hikers a day. That's, 1,500 a month. That's 4,500 a year. Over 10 years, that's 45,000 artifacts that could get hauled away or more.
Right. Well, and certainly nowadays, with the trail being so controlled for hikers and on the U.S. side, there's a lot of education attempts to tell people not
well,
to
helps.
Take things.
That helps, but there are people that'll still do it.
Right.
You can't stop them.
Right. Well, and people say before the Klondike Gold Rush Park was established, lots of people in Skagway and hikers mm-hmm. took all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So that probably happened on the Canadian side as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I was aware of that, but I never tried to quantify that. But my encounters suggested that it was a frequent occurrence.
So if you...
And they would take things from the trail and they get to Lindeman and they put them on the sod roof mm-hmm. in the cabin.
Yeah.
So now the provenance is lost.
Yeah, you don't know where it came from originally. Yeah, and that's one reason. Like when you came across people who had things, did you encourage them to not take them with them?
Well, they'd already taken them.
Oh, so it didn't matter.
They're not going to turn around and hike all the way back up the trail.
No, but even so, if they left them where you met them, it would have been a moot point.
Out of context.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, when I was working on the cemetery project, I witnessed some people at Bennett, there were half a dozen of them, I think, and there were ground features from the shore outward where the stones had been piled up for keys and docks and things mm-hmm. like that. And they were going and they were ripping these out and throwing them in the water to make a big splash.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, over time, you lose the integrity because of these thoughtless human actions.
Yeah.
But, unless I got in there, you can't do that, and, load up the shotgun to chase them away.
What about the church at Bennett? Are you involved in any way with any of that preservation of it, or is there restoration plans for it?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
We did, I did arrange for some of the pieces that were taken from the church to be stored in Dawson.
Mm-hmm. So pieces were taken for...
Elements.
But they were taken by hikers, or they were
no,
taken...
No, no, by our staff.
For protection purposes.
Well, they bring them in and they make replicas.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, and some of the grave markers were in such poor condition that we fabricated replicas, and I arranged for the originals to be stored in Dawson.
Oh, okay. Why in Dawson and not in Whitehorse?
Well, because in Dawson they had a team that could catalog them and store them and conserve them and care for them. And in Whitehorse they had a warehouse. And everybody could go and work, you know, sort through things, and they got moved around.
Okay.
It was, in my opinion, the team in Dawson could do a better job of curating.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
No disrespect to my colleagues in Whitehorse, but the volume of curatorial work,
right.
You could never justify a full-time position to take care of that stuff.
Yeah.
So did you ever collaborate curation, collection stuff like with Deb Sanders and, but no, each side did its own thing. Okay. The other structure on the Canadian side I'm wondering about is the trapping cabin, the Helm family cabin.
Best person to talk to there is probably Christine.
Okay.
They adopted into their family. She's known them for years and years.
So Parks Canada has had nothing to do with preserving that or protecting that?
No, that's her house.
Yeah.
As far as I know, she lived there before it was a park, and she's living there. Mm-hmm. Now, and they just acknowledge that that's her cabin.
Right. And there was a sign on it that said...
Leave. Do not.
Know. Well, it had said, you know, if you're interested, you can look inside, but make sure the door's closed, but don't disturb anything.
Oh, you're not talking about Edna Helms' cabin?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we didn't go in. We didn't look
okay,
in.
Well, it's been more than 10 years since I've been up there, so maybe that's something new.
Mm-hmm. But it was not a Parks Canada sign. It was from her and the family.
Okay, that's new.
That said, this is a private residence.
Yeah, that's new. There were signs that said private. Mm-hmm. Please keep away.
Yeah. So it does say that it's private, and so that's why I just didn't know if Parks Canada had anything to do with it.
I hate to say it, but there are some tourists who just think that they can go anywhere they want and do anything they want. And
right.
Mm-hmm. When I was in Dawson, I remember observing after hours someone going gaining access to the SS Kino, and they were shinnying up the mast.
Whoa!
And I walked over and I said, "I'm sorry, the boat is closed, and you know you shouldn't be up there." This guy's hanging onto the pole like this, looking down, and he says, "Oh, really? Like, I didn't know."
Yeah.
Give me a break.
Wow.
And the museum had some trains.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I caught some guys with big wrenches taking parts off the train.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I sent them packing.
Yeah.
My wife was the director of the museum, so I felt I had authority.
Right. Well, I would wonder, in that case, would there be police involved? The RCMP weren't called?
No, I just made sure we got everything back from them. Mm-hmm. And they just thought that, oh, it's fine, you know, I don't see why I can't. So, well, actually, well, they're not taking care of it. Well, you know, as if taking bits and pieces away to 25 different places is going to be good for them. And they were eventually treated. The small Porter engine was restored and put on exhibit at Expo 86.
Oh.
So when it came back, it was fully restored.
Yeah.
So it did happen. But not no thanks to these guys with their wrenches trying to steal parts.
We were talking about the development of the Chilkoot Trail, and you mentioned in the 60s some of the corrections labor. Maybe it was the 70s. When did that happen?
There's a fellow named Vic Ogeson who was, I'm not sure what he was. He was one of the senior guys. He might have been the head of corrections. In fact, I think he probably was. And he was really proud of the program and what they were doing to know, improve the trail for hiking purposes.
And that was before it was a park?
Yes. Now, I don't know precisely when it became. It's not a site. It's a park. It's a National Historic Park.
Right.
And I'm not sure when.
The U.S. side was officially designated, I think, in 77, somewhere around there.
I'd have to take a look at the commemorative integrity statement. It'll say.
I don't know about the Canadian side.
Yeah. Well, if you want to put your device on hold for a minute, I'll go and out of date now. But
so, what is this report? It's the
These were the CRM documents that guided our management decisions for historic sites.
Okay.
And it said these are the things that are of national significance and why. And commemorative integrity is being retained if certain things, you know, if we can say certain things are occurring.
Okay.
And declared of national historic significance in 1987.
Okay.
Chilkoot Trail National Historic Site is part of the complex of Canadian National Historic Sites related to the Gold Rush. These sites, with some recommendations dating back to 1926, there was a plaque recognizing the Gold Rush in 1926. Consider the social, economic, and political components shaping the Yukon region over the last century. So in 1987, the board recommended that the context of the Klondike Gold Rush as a social phenomenon, the Chilkoot Trail is of national historic significance and its development jointly with the American Park Service as part of an international park should be encouraged.
Okay.
So the Historic Sites and Monuments Board gave us our direction.
In 1987.
In 1987. And as part of that, they said we should encourage working with the U.S. side.
Right. But some of the early trail development, like on the U.S. side, you know, they used corrections people too, I think. Or are they
I don't know.
Or is it confused?
I know nothing about that.
Or are they confused with the Canadian side? The Canadian side, you...
Is this going again?
Oh, yeah, it's going
again. Okay.
Yeah. That when the Canadian side used these corrections...
That was in the 60s.
Okay. So even in the 60s, there was interest in having the whole Chilkoot Trail be accessible.
I met Vic Ogeson in 1972, 73, and he spoke with some pride at, you know, this program. And I think he was looking at it not just from the historical point of view, but from the rehabilitation point of view. Better have them doing something like this and sitting in cells.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder where the idea came from that the trail needed work and they was a good crew to use.
I don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
Bruce Harvey was the superintendent at the time, and he would have been involved in that, but he's long since passed away.
The superintendent on this side, on the Canadian side. Right, okay.
Yeah, he was the superintendent for all the Yukon sites.
Okay.
Initially.
Okay. Angie, you had a question.
Yeah, having just come off the Chilkoot Trail, you know, we hiked from Skagway to Bennett. Are there still people who hike all the way from Skagway to Dawson City?
You mean from
Dyea?
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, from Dyea.
You'll get individuals who take on the challenge of doing reenacting the whole trip.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done reality TV where they've done it, and so yes.
Do they start in Seattle and take
I don't know.
Is there any thought about developing
Christine
that
would tell
as
you.
An official...
She'd be able to tell you more about that sort of activity than I can.
Mm-hmm. Is there any thought about developing that whole corridor so that someone could travel all the way from Seattle?
For tourism?
Well, they can do that now.
But it's independently kind of...
You can get on a ferry in Seattle or take one of the cruise ships and it'll take you all the way to Skagway.
Mm-hmm. And then... But they reenact it. Do they build a boat at Lindeman? And
some of them do.
Wow.
Yep. National Geographic sponsored Keith Trick back in the 70s. And they did that. They built a raft and floated down the Yukon River. It took them 2 years because they were filming it. So.
Right.
But
Succeeded. He succeeded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing I know you have worked on, you know, larger Yukon history and the Dalton, Jack Dalton and the Dalton Trail story. That's out of Haines. Is that where that trail went from? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the first thing I'll say is I found it quite interesting that during the centennials, which were acknowledged both on the American side and the Canadian side, that there was little mention made of the Dalton Trail. I'd become aware of the Dalton Trail back in 1972, partly because of Alan Innes Taylor. He ranted about a fellow who was kind of a local mining developer, you know, at the huckster scale. In my mind, I visualize this guy as a hustler rather than a genuine mining investor. And remember he talked about, you're going to lose your recorder there.
Thanks. Okay.
I remember him ranting about this fellow taking a bulldozer and pushing the old buildings back, which I saw. I mentioned what I saw, and he said, oh, I know all about that. And that was what got me thinking about conservation. But I learned quite a bit about the Dalton Trail that summer, and over the course of the winter, I prepared about a 30-page submission to the Historic Sites and Monuments Board to convince them that they should declare it of national significance. They turned it down, but I did my best. And I documented the damage that was occurring and tried to place it in a historical context. So, but during the centennials, you looked at various documents and displays and posters, and they'd forgotten all about the Dalton Trail. Yet it was extremely important. You know, at one point it was thought it would be the main route to get to the coast, and that two or three different companies took an interest in developing a railroad over that route. And in 1897, a government surveyor actually surveyed the, you know, not detailed instrument survey, but he walked the route and to determine, you know, the feasibility of developing a railroad. And he went all the way from Pyramid Harbor to Fort Selkirk. But of course, the Chilkoot Trail was the preferred route for most. And one of the prime reasons, as you know, is because it was only, what, 26 miles?
33 miles.
33
now
miles.
Now it's 33 miles.
Okay.
It may have been 26 at the time.
I don't know. Anyway, 33 miles to Bennett, whereas the trip from Pyramid Harbor to the Yukon River was a couple of hundred miles. So it wasn't feasible to trek your supplies over like it you could over the Chilkoot Trail. So that was one thing that was not in its favor. But the Mounted Police set up posts along the trail and monitored the trail. And it became the preferred route for taking cattle into the Klondike. And thousands of head of cattle were taken in that way over a period of 10 years, including Jack Dalton. But others, Pat Burns, who became one of the biggest meat packers in Canada, certainly in Western Canada, made a bundle taking cattle in. And George Tuxford, a farmer from Saskatchewan, took a small herd in and documented it in a 250-page memoir. So, you know, we got lots of detail on its use as a route for the cattle drives. And that was probably the single thing that stood out in terms of the gold rush as the function of the Dalton Trail.
So for people who don't know...
Have you read my book?
I have not, but I'm aware of it. I should. I've heard you give that the Alaska Historical Society conference in Haines I believe you gave a presentation.
Perhaps. I might have done. I think I would. That was the year I was the keynote speaker, and yes. I also gave a talk about the Dalton Trail.
Yeah, so that's why I know you know something about the Dalton Trail.
Yes.
But so for people who don't know, where did the Dalton Trail go, and who started it, and all that?
Well, who started it was an Aboriginal trade route.
Okay.
And in fact, this fall in October, they're having a big celebration because it's been 150 years since George Davidson talked to Ku Klux about the trail, and Ku Klux created the famous map.
Ku Klux map, yes. I'm aware. Lyndon Johnson's.
Yes.
Yes. So it, like the Chilkoot, was a traditional trade route.
There were a network of trade routes all along the coast, where the coastal people were trading to the interior, and that was one of them. And so I start my book by talking about the indigenous use of the trail, and how trade was first established. Mm-hmm. It's embedded in oral history.
Right, right, and then. So during the gold rush, some people did use it, or what? When it was the main route for the cattle. What time period are we talking about?
There's something that happened in between the gold rush and the traditional use. Europeans were starting to penetrate the interior, and Orell Krauss was trying to, he went in over the Chilkoot to document things there. You know, he was a naturalist and collecting data and mm-hmm. taking samples and whatnot, and he wanted to do the same with the Chilkat, and he got them to take them to the point where in the distance he could see Coosawah Lake, but his guide claimed he wasn't feeling well and they couldn't go any farther, but I think he was essentially feeling stronger and stronger resistance to taking him in over this route, because they protected the routes. They were covetous of their routes.
Right.
And as you know, in 1852, Ku Klux participated in a raid at Fort Selkirk, where they drove out the Hudson's Bay Company.
Oh, right.
So in 1890, Frank Leslie's Illustrated Magazine funded an expedition. And Glave, Wells, Shands, and Dalton, there were a couple of others, embarked on a trip, and they went in from Klukwan up the Chilkat River over the summit and down onto Coosawah Lake. And they got halfway down the lake, and the party split in two. And the Wells and Shands carried on. Glave and Dalton turned left, and they went over Frederick Lake to Desdiash Lake, and then to Klukshu, and down to Nesketaheen. And then they hiked and made their way down the Tatchinchini, which was then called the Elsack, but it's now called the Tatchinchini, to a village which we tried to locate in 1972. It's, I don't know, 30 or 40 miles down the Tatchinchini River. It was a seasonal camp called Nukaik. And from there, Glave and Dalton secured a guide and a dugout, and they made their way down the Elsack River to its mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote about that. And so that was the first intrusion by white people. And then the following year, the two of them came back, and this time they took pack horses. And this time they went up over the route that is now part of the Haines Road.
Okay.
And they got to Nesketaheen, and they talked to the people who were there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Glave actually got some of them to make maps to show them the relationships of the lakes and rivers and the various features. And those are preserved at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
You may have seen them, I don't know.
Yeah.
But they made their way into an area around Clue Lake and then over to Kluwani, and then they returned via the Slims River and the Kaskawalch, and they came to where the Kaskawalch meets the Desdiash River, and now becomes the LSEC. Mm-hmm. And then they cut across country to Niskayuna and made their way out. And that was the first serious intrusion into the interior by Europeans. Mm-hmm. And that's where Dalton got the idea to make a trail. So he didn't find the trail. He just used the trail that was there.
Yeah.
And exploited it for his own purposes and became very proprietorial to the extent that he even charged First Nations people to use their own trail.
Right.
They could walk over it, but if they started taking anything in with them, then he charged them.
Because he was using it as a trading trail of his own.
Yeah, he'd take pack trains of supplies in before the gold rush, and they'd get to the Yukon River, and then they'd float down to 40 Mile to deliver their goods.
Right. But it's interesting that it did not get the attention during the gold rush. It seems like it might have been...
Well, I blame part of that on Pierre Burton. Pierre Burton has written the definitive work on the Klondike Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. It's a classic, and it's a masterpiece. And he's done more to influence our perception of the Klondike Gold Rush than any other single person. But he only devotes, I think I counted, 6 paragraphs that related to Dalton and the Dalton Trail. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he even includes a map of that in his book. Mm-hmm. So it was easy to overlook. And all these commemorations and exhibits that took place during the centennial years in the 90s, many of them neglected.
Yeah, well, that's why I brought it up, because it seems like it was a trail used during the Gold Rush era.
It was one of the most important routes. That's why I wrote a book about it.
But it wasn't. But as you say, the Stampeders maybe didn't use it because of the distance, but it was used to bring supplies and cattle.
Well, it was used to bring cattle in.
Yeah, so that then were feeding the Stampeders the way.
Yeah, I figured, I did some number crunching, and conservatively, a third of all the gold that was recovered in 1898 was spent on meat.
Wow.
You know, I it blew my mind. Because they were paying up to $2.50 a pound for meat that cost 5 cents a pound outside.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Just depended on, you know, the time of year and the shortage of supply and demand.
Yeah.
And at that price, you start, you know, calculating the number of head that went in, and they dressed out at about 600 to 800 pounds each, and you know, and then you figure out, you know, conservatively $1.50 a pound, how much is that? And I was surprised just how much.
Wow, yeah.
So it was a very lucrative business. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, and I always find it funny, you know, it's the Klondike Gold Rush, which is in Canada, but it's all, like, promoted as this big American thing over the Chilkoot Trail. So what's the Canadian take on the story?
Well, I think Pierre Burton has defined it for Americans and Canadians, because he wrote, his book came out as Klondike Fever in the States.
Mm-hmm.
Canadians laugh at the American perception that it's in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a standing joke. Mm-hmm. Dawson City, Alaska, Yukon, you know. Kathy is the director of the museum. Used to get letters addressed to her in the strangest ways, because people, you know, didn't know. Mm-hmm. And there is a tendency from the American point of view to take an American spin on things. And I know, you know, during the Gold Rush period, there was a big argument going on about where the boundary was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the American desire was for it to extend to the interior as far as Tagish.
Oh.
The Canadian and the British pushed back and said, no, we need a tidewater port. And I think the thing that did more than anything else to define the boundary is that Clifford Sifton instructed the Mounted Police to set up posts at the summits.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that on the White Pass, and they did that on the Chilkoot Pass. But when the detachment that was sent to the Chilkat Pass, they got as far as where the boundary is now, and they encountered like 20 feet of snow, and they couldn't go any farther. So they put their posts there. And you'll notice now the boundary comes down and it very neatly goes around the mounted police post. And so that was the Canadian action that ultimately defined where the boundary was defined in that area. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until 1903 that they signed off on it. It was another 3 years before they did the survey work. Mm-hmm. So they kept the mounted police post active there until the official boundary work was finished, and then they pulled it out.
Well, I heard they used to have a cannon or something up there, too, during the Gold Rush.
Well, they might have been on the Chilkoot.
Yeah.
They certainly had a Maxim gun.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, which I don't know exactly what that is, but...
Well, it's a form of machine gun.
Oh, okay.
Oh, those old... I've never seen one, but that's what it was, essentially. Right.
That was to protect the border, I guess.
How's that for an informed description?
The visual of spinning and turning a crank.
Yeah, aiming it and turning the crank that feeds the bullets into the chamber.
Yeah. Something else I was doing.
Well, you were asking about the Dalton Trail.
Well, yeah, and the perceptions of the Gold Rush. In Alaska, it's called the Alaska Gold Rush. But it wasn't in Alaska.
No, it wasn't. And just a reflection on it, there was a young fellow who was born in Dawson City. He became a motion picture star. His name is Victor Jory. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was Helen Keller's father in The Miracle Worker. He was a popular film star in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. You look at his... You know, they all have a legend. They all have a, their background story. And in theirs, they shaped it so he was from Alaska.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because that appeals to the American mass market. Mm-hmm. And so there's that built-in bias against acknowledging, anything that isn't American, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know I was going to ask you about that. You've also been writing articles for the White Horse newspaper, correct?
Yukon News, that's correct. Closing in on 600 articles.
Wow. And so what do you write about?
Well, after we're finished, I can show you because I've saved I've clipped copies of everything I've written. But people, places, and events. I do book reviews, describe things like the YHMA Heritage Awards and the Transportation Hall of Fame Awards, and I never know where the stories are going to be inspired, or where they'll come from, and that's better than having a rigid structure of I'll only write about this.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes someone will get in touch and they're seeking their family story, and I'll talk to them, and an interesting story emerges.
Mm-hmm.
We got a call last year. This family was interested in looking into their ancestor, George Patton Mackenzie. I did a quick scan, and I realized that there was a motherload of information, and I was too busy, so I asked Kathy if she was interested, and she contacted these people, and in the end... And I can show you. She produced four binders.
Wow.
That much material
on
George Patton Mackenzie. And so I, extracted some from that, and I wrote a column about that. So I never know where the stories are going to come from. This week's column is a book review about the Caribou Hotel.
No.
It's a new book that just came out.
Where is the Caribou Hotel here in Whitehorse?
No, it's the one in Carcross.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. Right next to Matthew Watson's store.
Oh, yeah. Well, we saw that building. We were wondering. Yeah. I said it looks like an old hotel.
Yeah.
It's being restored
At one point, it belonged to Dawson Charlie, one of the discoverers of the Klondike.
Oh.
So there's a lot of history there.
That's great. And so it's a weekly column.
Now it's a bi-weekly, but I've been doing it for 13 years now.
So bi-weekly means every 2 weeks?
Every 2 weeks.
Okay. I was thinking, it's interesting that the local newspaper has a history column.
Oh, it's popular. All the other columnists got cut. I'm one of the last men standing. Mm-hmm. So that I hope that's a reflection that there are readers who... I know I get lots of people who talk to me about something I've written in the newspaper. So, but it's one way of... I don't know. I just love exploring the old records and, you know, there are so many interesting people here.
Mm-hmm.
Morley Bones. He was a fellow who lived out at Silver City on Kluane Lake, and he established a fox farm there for furs. Mm-hmm. But he was also an outfitter, and there's a book, Yukon Trophies Won and Lost, where they describe him guiding them from, I think, Valdez through the mountains to in the end, they ended up in Whitehorse.
Wow.
And they got to the White River, and they had, you know, all these trophies, you know, horns and antlers and hides and whatnot. So they found an old scow, and they fixed it up, and they loaded all the trophies in, and they started going down the White River, and it caught on something, and it turned over, and everything went to the bottom of the river.
Mm-hmm.
That winter, when it was 40 below, Morley Bones and one of the Jacko brothers came back out to the site, and they built a caisson of ice down to the river bottom to see if they could recover any of the trophies. Spent a month.
And did they?
They found the spot. There are pictures. There's actually a picture of the caisson. You can see a bit of the boat in the corner. But no, they weren't able to recover anything.
Yeah.
But he was a man of his word, and he said he'd do his best to recover them.
Right.
And they spent a month at 40 below trying to do that.
Wow.
Can't ask for more.
Yeah, I think I've heard about the story of them going down the river and it flipping and losing
it,
but I don't think I've ever heard the other end of it,
well,
that they went back.
Well, just wait a moment. I'll show you the pictures.
Okay.
You'll be interested to know that all the time I worked for Parks Canada, I never did the entire trail.
You never hiked the entire trail?
Well, actually, in 2001, I took a holiday. And a friend came up from Vancouver, and we hiked it then. And I'll add that the rangers on the American side were very hospitable to us.
Did you tell them that you worked for Parks Canada?
Yeah.
Oh, you did.
Yeah. But I wasn't there on in an official capacity. But
well, how many times did you hike up and down the Canadian side?
Oh, I don't know, half a dozen times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were there ever any times that new artifacts were found, new things came up and were found that you had to go assess?
Well, the cemeteries,
right.
Finding that, you know, where those infants were buried, you know, that was kind of a touching moment.
Right.
I tend to remember things like the bear encounters.
Oh my gosh. Well, those are good stories.
Yeah. Well, I came in one time and... I'm trying to remember who it was I came in with, but we boated in from Bennett, and we were about to land at Lindeman, and a big bear came out on the beach and was wandering back and forth. So we did circles out in the lake for about half an hour until we hadn't seen it for a while before we landed. And then there were four of us, and one was Jerry Van Ryn, who was the engineer doing a bridge survey of the trail. And we had dinner that evening, and he was washing dishes inside the bunk, or the kitchen.
The warden's
cabin, kitchen. And I was outside chopping wood, and all of a sudden he shouted, "There's a bear!" So I came running around the corner of the cabin, and there was the bear.
Wow.
Yep, there was a bear. And but he just wandered off.
Black or brown?
That was black bear. The only, we call them grizzlies.
Yeah.
The only time I've ever seen a bear, it's usually been going in the other direction.
That's the best way.
That's the best way.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So when are you retired now?
I retired in 2008.
Okay. And what have you been doing? Writing books and articles since then?
Yeah. Yep. The first thing I did after I retired was I got Ron Chambers to take me down the Desdiash River. I was looking for part of the trail, the Dalton Trail, the footpath.
Right.
Because I had hiked other portions and there was a well-defined trail, so I knew there had to be something there somewhere. And that was one of the high points of my life, doing that trip, because he has indigenous ancestry, but he was also a warden with Kewaunee Park for many years. And he combined those two things in a remarkable way. And he was always looking for anything, you know, any flakes or artifacts or anything that indicated prehistoric use.
Yeah.
He worked with Scotty McNeish, who did archaeological work here in the late 50s and early 60s, when he was just a lad.
Yeah. So did you find any evidence of that old pathway?
No, but we found Pennock's Post, which was built in 1898 and was well documented. Mm-hmm. I came back the next summer with another friend, and we went to the same place. And I thought, well, we couldn't find it, but if we start at this spot on the bank of the river and we go straight toward the mountains, we're going to find that trail somewhere. And we went all the way through the bush and the swamp, and we got to the mountain, and we never found the trail. And we hiked back, and we came out a little bit farther along the lake shore, and there was the trail. And we followed it back right into the camp that we were camped in. And when I walked on the other side of the camp, I followed the trail out of the camp and down. We just didn't look in the right place the first time.
Well, that must have been pretty exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, it was satisfying, very satisfying.
So that was the last, quote, missing piece for the
whole
Dalton Trail?
No, there were lots of missing pieces, but it was just one of the links in the chain.
Yeah. I have sort of a philosophical question. Actually, I have two, and I'll just join them together because maybe they're related somewhat. At the beginning, you were talking about the men who just went down to the shop to grab the tools to use because that's what they were used to doing. Mm-hmm. So my question is, when does history end and when does preservation begin, if that makes sense? Well, and then secondly, what do you hope that people 100 years from now are able to see of the Chilkoot Trail and, you know, Dawson City? And what do you hope that they learn from it?
That's two very separate questions.
But they might tie, yeah, they sort of tie together. I mean,
you want to repeat? No.
Right. So history versus preservation.
Well, yeah. When I was in Dawson, Kathy and I started making annual pilgrimages to the gold fields to document what we found. And that was so immense that I ended up focusing on one tributary, Gold Run Creek. And I spent 20 years visiting the site, talking to the miners and documenting the historical remains. And as their work progressed, things eventually got destroyed and lost. Documented their work as well. And I was once lamenting to a miner that, it's a shame to see all this history, you know, being lost. And he says, well, we're making history. So where does the history end and non-history begin? As far as he was concerned, history is what we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And all that other stuff, it's gone, but we're making history. It all depends on your perspective and how you define it. Mm-hmm. And I know that different cultural resource management regimes apply different criteria to establishing what is historical and what is not. Historic Sites and Monuments Board won't even consider a nomination until a certain amount of time has passed, for example. And I know that territorial parks, they do the same thing. If it's not so many years old, it's not worth considering. And with the Federal Heritage Building Review Office, it was 40 years, I think, which meant that the Palace Grand Theater only became of real historical interest in 2000, when it was 40 years old.
Okay.
Before that, it was a contemporary structure.
Okay.
So, to answer your question, it all depends on who you are. doesn't it?
Okay.
Well, that leads
me. The other question. What was the other question?
What do you hope that people 100 years from now are able to see of the Chilkoot Trail in Dawson City? And what do you hope they take away from it? What do you hope they learn?
Well, I'm not optimistic that they're going to see much because of natural processes and the gradual human attrition. And that was something that occurred, dawned in my mind back in 1972. And I was a poor, starving student, and you know, I was way down at the bottom of the pecking order, and so I thought it really meant a lot to me. And so I reframed the question as, what can I do? And I said, well, I can't preserve these things because that takes money and resources and that. But what I can do is I can see these places and I can record them to the best of my ability when I'm able to, so that we have a record of what was there. And I've done that ever since, whenever I can. Now it's sort of sad to go back to some of these places and see how far they've declined. I did two trips on the 40 Mile River, and in the second one I was with the Bureau of Land Management, and we got to this one site, and I had lots of photographs of what was there the previous visit, which was 7 years earlier, and a forest fire had gone through, and all that was left was some bed springs and a stove. Everything else burned to the ground. So I know these processes take place. And there's not much we can do about it. We can work really hard. And I realize that's why I really enjoyed working for Parks Canada. We had targeted a number of buildings. And we said, we'll do our utmost to preserve the integrity of these buildings. Because, and I knew that they couldn't do it all. And I liked the model that, that they had chosen and the representative selection they had made and so forth. And worked very happily in that paradigm while I was a curator. So I was actually employed to do what, in my heart, I wanted to do. So that, not many people get to say that, but I get to say that.
Right. Well, yeah, that was one of my questions of what you enjoyed about your jobs, the Dawson one or the White Horse.
Well, that was a big one.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that I now had a job where I could make a difference.
And any regrets?
Not really.
Or things you wished you could have accomplished that you were not able to?
I accomplished as much as I could. I, you know, I feel good about that. You know, I wasn't a nine-to-fiver. And what I did in my off hours, you know, reinforced what I was doing when I was in the office. You know, no, I have no regrets. And
what about particular challenges you faced?
Well, one was the, and I didn't realize this at first, but my campaign to make people aware of the concept of preservation. You know, when I first arrived in Dawson, they didn't have that. You know, the theater troupe that performed in the Palace Grand Theater, every spring they'd come and find, you know, what they could from the collection to use as props on stage. And I took great pains to explain that they couldn't do that anymore, and I explained why. I always explained why. You know, these are national treasures, you know. You want to have a cocktail party, you don't go to the Louvre and borrow the Mona Lisa to provide background. Well, these things are treasures. And I said, that's the way we have to treat them. And so over time, the culture changed and they became more sensitive and responsive to the point where the engineers from Winnipeg would still come in and try to steamroll their projects through without CRM. But the employees, we had this network and they wouldn't let them get away with it.
Nice.
I love that.
That's great.
So that was really great. You know, and they were working on the Palace Grand Theater and they'd done some trenching to, you know, wires or pipes or something. And the guys all were filling us in on what was there. And we went down and looked and we were able to get them to put the project, that work, on hold so we could examine and record. And our conservator did some had an archaeological experience, did some excavating and so forth before they proceeded. So it was nice to have that and to see them engage in discussions. I gave a talk 2 years ago on CRM to the staff, and they came in, and there was one fellow, Tom. He is so bored about things like going to attend talks, you know, especially, you know, on health and safety or whatever it is. And but I was talking about how, you know, you intervene and the values and what you're trying to preserve and how you learn from what you see and how you plan your work so that you protect these things. And you could see him light up and he started talking. And I thought, I've connected. Yeah. If I can get old Tom to get talking about this, I know that I'm beaten on the right drum here. So that felt kind of good. And the fact that they asked me back to talk about it, and part of it was the supervisor had, we had done this project on Robert Service Cabin before I left Dawson. And what they had to do was work on the roof. You heard me talk about the roof.
Right.
Well, in 1991 and 92, we restored, we moved dredge number 4. It was a massive undertaking.
Right.
And in order to do that, they built a huge berm. And then they lined the inner side of it with rubber so they could fill it with water to float the dredge to move it on to a new location. Afterwards, they rolled up all the rubber and they put it away for future use. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to sod roof on top of the, which was not historical, by the way, sod roof on service cabin. They were concerned about water penetration and they wanted to, you know, put this rubber membrane underneath the sod to protect the the interior of the cabin from leakage. So he came to me and he said, you know, can we do a CRM on this? And I said, sure. So I went digging through all the records and I realized that that wasn't, in fact, the roof that was on there originally, that some architect had got to fulfill their fantasy for a cabin and they changed it entirely. So I said to him, you know, you've got rotten components there, but they're not historical. And, you know, you can replace those planks, no problem. And I said, but if you ever get to the point where you have to do a major intervention on the roof, this is what it looked like, not what's there now. And that is, that's your benchmark. That's what you should strive for. And I think he bought into that. He got it. I showed him the pictures and we talked a lot. And it was talking and not just spouting principles, but, you know, explaining why and showing the pictures and going up and examining it and you know, getting your hands on. Right. I think that made the difference, especially with any people who are in the trades. They understand that more than you sitting in your office, you know, spouting platitudes.
Right. Well, that, of course, leads to the question of in historic restoration, to what time period are you restoring something?
Well, that,
and how you make that decision.
That's a toughie, but I'll give you an example. We had the commissioner's residence, and it went through three different forms. It was built, at first it was just a box. And then in 1903, the commissioner at the time had it modified and they turned it in, it looked like a Louisiana bordello with all this gingerbread work and balconies and these little cupolas on top that everybody called ballot boxes because he was known for his corrupt electoral practices. And then they had a fire, and when they replaced it, they left it in they restored it to the configuration it has now. So a lot of people thought we should go back to the gingerbread because they liked that. That looked really neat. And I looked at it and I said, well, the current configuration conforms with a historic event. And this was 1908, so we're within the period of commemoration. So we don't have to rip all that off to recreate something that doesn't exist there anymore. And I said, we have excellent documentation for what the building looked like inside and out. And we have 70% of the original furnishings survived, and we were able to use them when we did the refurnishing inside. Mm-hmm. And so in that particular case, you know, we balanced the, you know, the two choices, and we went with the later period. So we preserved the configuration that came after the fire in 1905. And we were able to use the original artifacts that survived from the period. And it was also a time when George and Martha Black occupied the building, and they were quite prominent in Yukon history as well. So that was one. Some of them are, you know, they're a little bit more challenging. I mean, the idea of just replacing the roof of the Robert Service cabin on a whim without any historical evidence, that I always had a hard time with that.
Well, and in some cases, you don't have this great historical documentation, like the commissioner's residence. You had all those photos and all that. What do you do if you don't have that? How do you know?
Well, we always treated it as CRM is a knowledge-based decision-making process. So you say, what do we know about the resource? And you gather as much information as you have before you sit down to discuss it. Mm-hmm. That's where you start.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I'm thinking, like, if you have no resources, if you can't find any resources, how do you know where to start?
When I did the restoration for the commissioner's residence, I remember we got agreement with the curatorial and conservation people in Winnipeg to treat some of the material. So we shipped it to Winnipeg, and the day it arrived, I got a phone call saying, you know, this stuff is, you know, it's eclectic. There's this and there's that, and, you know, we question whether this is valid or not. So I took the photographs of those pieces of furniture in the building in the period of commemoration, and I mailed them a package, or I faxed them. Mm-hmm. But anyway, after that, they shut up.
Yeah.
What they do is, failing any information, they default to a theme room approach.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We know it's of this age, so I'll pick things that I'm familiar with from that time period.
Right. Yeah.
So what you end up with is the a creation of the curator rather than a historical rendering.
Yeah,
right. You know that was the style of furniture in that time period or something.
Well, I know because we have pictures of that furniture in that room. We had the inventories.
Right.
I knew where they purchased it. I found catalogs.
Right. But if you don't have all that, as you say, well, we know it was from this time period, so we'll put other
they do
pieces.
The best, they do the best they can.
Right.
But I think all too often, curators default to a theme room approach.
It's
not always, but I've seen a lot of that.
It's easier, probably.
Well, when you have no evidence to rely upon, what do you do?
Right. That was my question.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
Well, this
you use the best knowledge and the best evidence and the best skills that you've acquired as a curator.
Yeah. And we were talking before we started recording about, you know, history and quote unquote getting it right, and what is accurate history, and that sort of ties in with this.
Well, okay, you think something like the discovery of the Klondike, that's pretty straightforward.
Right.
But you see, around 1903, there was a movement afoot to have Robert Henderson declared the official discoverer of the Klondike. And the reason for that was he was a Canadian. And they lobbied the Canadian government, and the government acceded to their petitioning, and they declared him the official discoverer of the Klondike and gave him a pension for life.
Wow.
Okay. Wow. But he was cut out of the action because he was a racist, and he refused to deal with Skookum Jim and Dawson Charlie when, or Tagish Charlie as he was known then, when they visited his camp on Hunker Creek before they made the discovery. And they weren't going to go all the way back over the hill to tell him after that. So then there's discussion about, well, Carmack filed the discovery claim, but William Ogilvy interviewed them all, and they sat down together, and they came to the consensus it was Skookum Jim who found the gold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they've had three different plaques at the discovery claim. And over time, the emphasis has shifted, mm-hmm. depending upon the current thinking. Now, National Prospecting Chamber of Mines, they have a Hall of Fame, and they've just inducted George Carmack's wife, Kate, mm-hmm. because she's not only Indigenous, but she's a woman. And that lends itself to contemporary perspective. Unfortunately, she wasn't with them when the discovery occurred. Mm-hmm. But it's a popular perspective now, and you get your fingers whacked with the ruler if you say, oh, but she wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and similarly, it transitioned from it was Henderson or Carmack to the recognition that
Skookum
it
Jim.
Was the First Nation, yeah. Skookum Jim and yep. Tagish Charlie.
That's right.
That.
That's right. So there you've got three or four different renderings of everybody wants to have a piece of the action and mm-hmm. discovery. And the same thing happened in California, you know.
Yeah.
The poor guy that made the discovery in the mill race at Sutter's Mill.
Yeah.
You know, they hounded him for the rest of his life, thinking he had the magic touch. But I must say that Skookum Jim and Dawson Charlie fared much better than, what's his name, from the California Gold Rush.
Well, John Sutter is Sutter's Mill.
No, it wasn't Sutter.
I know, I can't remember who the other person is.
Yeah. Anyway, they fared much better. And Skookum Jim left a legacy that grew over time, and they were able to tap into that to create the Skookum Jim Friendship Center mm-hmm. about 20 years ago, 25
That's
years
ago. That's
here
in Whitehorse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was, and the Caribou Hotel is mm-hmm. one of the legacies left to remind us of Dawson Charlie.
Yeah, in Carcross.
Yep.
So is can one say you ever get history right?
Well, there are certain things, like the date that George Carmack signed the affidavit for the discovery claim,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have documentation of that, and you know, that's probably an immutable fact. Mm-hmm. But there are so many different versions swirling around the discovery that becomes open to debate.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on who you're saying. George Carmack was interviewed some years later about the discovery, and he said, "Well, you know, the gold was there, and I was just the lucky one who came." Found it. Anybody could have found it.
Right.
Whoever happened to be there and tried the waters would have found it. And so he was saying, you know, he wasn't trying to make a big deal out of him being the discoverer, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, right.
So, and I guess it depends on everything you do. I thought about that a lot. I mean, during you know, the 1930s, Germany tried to remake their entire heritage and fabricate this new history where Germans, the Aryan race,
right.
were responsible for civilization everywhere. Politicians like to turn events into significant things for their campaigns. You know, people hold history up all the time for one purpose or another. You know, people want their relatives to have an important place in history, and you see that a lot in the Klondike Gold Rush.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how many people have claimed that they met Jack London, even when it was physically impossible.
Yeah. Right.
And I've been criticized for pointing that out. But and then there are the ones who remember camping with Robert Service on the Chilkoot during the Gold Rush. Of course, he
was not there.
1906.
Yeah.
He never did that. But, you know, people want to do it. And then another example, the shooting of McGinnis. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but Jack Dalton killed a man in Haines in 1892. Mm-hmm. And I tracked that story back to a book that was published in 1947. And it was the reminiscences of a fellow 50 years after the facts, more than 50 years later. And he created this thing that I think he'd seen too many Westerns in between. Mm-hmm. And it was a gunfight, guns blazing, matter of honor, and all that stuff. Well, Bruce Parham gave me sent me a copy of the trial transcript. Mm. And when you compare that with this, it was Mont Hawthorne was the fellow's name who related the story. It was a total fabrication. But I found that Mont Hawthorne fabrication repeated over and over and over again in books after, because they all went to that one and used the story.
Well, that's a common thing. That's what's with Klondike Fever. The same thing is done. Everybody uses that as the end-all, be-all source, and it gets repeated. And
well,
I'm sure I've been guilty of it, because if you don't know the subject, you don't know
you
that
you default to what's available. I understand
right,
that.
Right, and you default to what you think is the best source.
Well, and another example is Klondike Kate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a book written by Ellis Lucia about Klondike Kate, and I had some difficulty with it. You know, they claim she was the queen of the ball and, mm-hmm. you know, the queen of theater and
she
all
was
that
in,
stuff.
She was in Dawson, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was. There's no question about that.
Right.
That's well documented. But her stature is was elevated substantially in this book, and everybody has glommed onto that, and they've made her the queen of the Klondike. Well, I found a number of places where I can document the exaggerations in this book, so I know that he's prone to overstating it. And I went back to find evidence that she was the preeminent person during the Gold Rush is Cad Wilson, and who probably deserves that Queen of the Klondike more than Kate Rockwell. When Kate Rockwell was in Dawson, anytime you find her name, you know, in the theater reviews or the advertisements for the stage performance that's coming up, her name would be in the middle of a cast of a dozen. So they didn't put her up in big letters.
Right.
And she was noted in the newspapers for putting on things like Sunday afternoon when the theaters were compelled to shut down. She put on a series of tableaus. Mm-hmm. You know what tableaus are? Living human
yeah. mm-hmm.
tableaus.
Mm-hmm.
The curtains part and everybody's frozen, you know, to represent the Last Supper or the rape of the Sabine women or, you know, something like that.
Right.
And then the curtains close and you hear rumble, 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 and they're dragging the furniture around. And then they open it up as another piece of classic art. And everybody goes, ooh, and ah, and they close the curtains.
Yeah.
And that was her forte.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked in the census records, and they had a listing of, I found her name, and she was listed with about a dozen others from the theater. And the actresses started at $400 a month,
mm-hmm.
and then $300 a month. And Kate was at the bottom at $200 a month. She was not the featured act.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the end, I realized, and nobody called her Klondike Kate. That came when she showed up at the Pantages trial in 1929,
mm-hmm.
and the press started calling her that, and she grabbed that and ran with it.
Oh, right.
So
well, that shows you the influence of the press, which, you know, they continue to do that, you
well,
know.
All the old-timers loved it. They all remembered her.
Right.
And so she was Klondike Kate. She embodied that glorious period from
she
the past that they
that,
all participated in.
She took on that fame. Why not?
Yeah.
Another thing I want to quickly ask about, you mentioned surveying the road, archaeological survey. That's the South Klondike Highway between Whitehorse and Skagway?
Yeah. The BC provincial archaeologist plucked me out of a project I was working on in BC to lead a crew of two to go over the route that the road was to follow.
Mm-hmm.
to ensure that the archaeological resources weren't, or determine what would, how, what the impact would be. And I remember when I got there, at the end of the road was the BC border, and they had a bulldozer sitting there idling. And they hadn't moved into BC yet, and the project engineer for the road said, can you at least give us the green light on the first 5 miles? And so that was the first thing we had to do.
And did you...
We backpacked. We hiked in. That was the only way we could get to these places.
And was the route already flagged?
Nope. We had... The route was marked on topo maps.
Okay. So you had something to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And did you find things?
A little bit. But nothing of grave consequence. But we weren't able to cover the entire thing that summer. So the next year, the fellow who assisted me came back in with another archaeologist, and they completed the portions that we weren't able to get to.
And then who did the, was the U.S. part done and the Yukon part done? Because you just did the B.C.
Well, the road was all the way up to the B.C. border, so there was no argument about that. And we got as far as the B.C. border. We camped on a little flat spot right next to the boundary marker, overlooking the tracks. We set up our little base camp there, and then we started working back along the route that the road was to follow. They dropped us off at Log Cabin, and we hiked all the way from Log Cabin. We backpacked from there up the railroad to the summit, and then we started working our way back down from over the route that was the road was to follow.
And did the road follow the old White Pass Bennett Road trail?
No, because it's one peak over.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the railroad followed that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you don't know how they picked the route for the road.
Well, they would have worked with aerial photographs, and I don't know what was already on the American side. If the American side got it partway up, they'd say, well, we'll just link up with what they've got.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either. That wasn't part of my job.
I would have assumed they start from this end because... It ends on the American side, but I don't know.
I don't know.
But that also leads me to think, did you do any archaeological survey work on the Chilkoot Trail? Because I know Carl Gerke...
No, they had archaeologists to do that.
Okay. So that was... At that point, you were working in Dawson, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know Carl Gerke and folks did that on the U.S. side and numbered and mapped everything. Do you know if it was done on the Canadian side?
Oh, they worked it to death.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, in later years when I was in Whitehorse, the superintendent for the Chilkoot grumbled every time the word archaeology came up because, in his opinion, they'd done far too much.
Yeah.
Oh,
I bet.
Okay. And then just want to wrap up with what we are not going to talk about today, maybe, which is the film project, the Dawson City film project, which is a whole nother story, and you've been interviewed about it a lot, but I just want it recorded that you were involved in finding those films. And
I was, and it was quite circumstantial. It wasn't part of my mandate or my job,
mm-hmm.
but I was young and had lots of energy, and I felt that we can't let one more thing get lost. I'd heard so many old timers talk about things being thrown out and thrown away and given away. I don't know, there was something that I needed to find somebody who might care about these.
Did you ever think about the similarities between the discovery of gold and the discovery of the films?
No.
No?
No. Not at all. Right. I wasn't looking for it.
And that was in 1978.
Eight.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't part of our mandate. And I ended up doing a lot of my involvement in that after hours.
Right.
So my boss wouldn't grumble as much. And I never had, at the time, I never conceived that it would be one of the things that keeps coming back to haunt
me
at this end of my career.
Right. Well, that's why I say it's a whole long story, but those were old films that had been shown in Dawson in, what, 19... 19-
Well, between 1905 and 1925.
Right.
And what sparked it for me was finding an advertisement for one of the reels of film that I had just looked at. Mm. And it was shown in the theater in 1917.
Right.
The Strange Case of Mary Page was the title.
Well, that's right. And it was old nitrate film that was very flammable and had to be conserved. And that was a huge project.
My last sort of involvement in the project was trying to figure out how to get it to Ottawa. And so we had these crates built and had them lined with metal. I later learned that it probably would have been a useless gesture. Once those things catch fire, there's no putting them out. Wow. And at one point, I took about 4 feet of nitrate film, and I held it over a galvanized garbage barrel, and I lit the bottom and dropped it in. And the flame shot 8 feet in the air, and it melted the galvanizing off the outside.
Wow.
It has, ounce for ounce or gram for gram, it has 13 times the BTUs of wood. So when it burns, it's incredibly intense.
Wow.
And I've been told, but I never tried it, it burns underwater. You can attest to that.
I've seen videos of that.
Yeah. Okay, so you know. So it was a very dangerous material. We had this ton of film loaded into these crates. And then how do we get them out of town? Well, there happened to be a moving company in town, and they were moving somebody's domestic haul, and they had room on their truck. So we were able to get these crates onto the truck, and they got it to Whitehorse. And then I went to Whitehorse, and I said, you know, can we arrange to get these to Ottawa? And he said, oh, we've been listening to the radio. We know what that is, and we're not going to touch it.
You made your hazmat.
So I went down to Greyhound, and he said, you know, any chance you could transport these? We know what that stuff is. We're not going to touch it. And I went and talked to the trucking outfits, and they knew that they wouldn't touch it. And Canadian Pacific Airlines would have nothing to do with it. So I went back, and I was mulling this over a coffee break, and one of my colleagues was retired from the military, and he says, well, the Armed Forces does that stuff all the time. So we relayed this to Sam Kula, and he got his boss to talk to someone in Department of National Defense, and they sent a Hercules up, and they picked the film up.
Oh, I thought you were going to have to drive it yourself to Ottawa.
I would have.
Well, I really appreciate your time this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Any other thing about the work you've done in Yukon history or Klondike Chilkoot stuff that we haven't talked about? That was on your mind when I initiated this thing. We want to make
sure. Well, mostly it was my fear of not having a lot to say about, you know, the Chilkoot, and there are other people who are far more knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I thought it was going to be a very short interview.
Well, I mean, your experiences on the Chilkoot doing the CRM, I mean, that is a unique thing. So you did have some special moments out there.
A little bit.
Yeah. You have a favorite spot on the trail?
I have a favorite moment.
Okay.
It was early one morning at Bennett. And I'd just gotten up. I got out of my tent, and I was sitting at one of the picnic tables. And I heard a wolf howl across the lake, and it echoed across the lake. And it was just dead calm. The sun was just coming up, and it was just raking the mountaintops. And there was a bit of a chill in the air, and then this howl pierced the silence.
Uh-huh.
I remember that.
That's beautiful.
But that's one of many, many.
Well, that actually makes me think about a question about, you know, the Chilkoot Trail and the continued preservation of it. Now, is it more a wilderness nature experience to be preserved versus
I'll leave that up to somebody else.
Versus a history thing to be preserved.
It'll always be a history thing as far as I'm concerned. And we must not lose sight of that.
Okay.
And they have the warden service in there. Turn your machine off.
Okay. Okay, we're just going to sign off here, and thank you very much for your stories and perspective. It's been great. Angie, anything else from you?
Thanks. This has been wonderful.
Right.
Okay.
We'll save the rest for another interview, right?
Sometime.
Sometime. All right. And looking forward to your book about the film project.
Well, it'll be a couple of years, yeah. But I'm working. I've got one that it's got to be to the publisher by October. So
all right.
That comes first. But yeah.
Great. Thanks.